Does anyone else have the heebie-jeebies? No. Good. So shut up. The Berkeley Internet
Radio Network. Coming to you live from the Uchida building, this is the Zach Kuhn Show. I'm your host, Zach Kuhn. And joining me in the studio is Anthony Amore. Anthony, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Zach.
Anthony he works at the Isabel Stewart Gardner Museum. He is the head of security, and he's also in charge with finding 15 paintings that were stolen from the museum.
13.
Oh, I'm sorry, no. 13.
You don't have to memorize this stuff. That's perfectly fine.
13 paintings that were stolen from the museum. I just want to say I'm super excited to have you here and to talk to you because in the past I've had a lot of musicians on and I've had a lot of musical guests and that kind of thing. So I'm super excited to talk with someone who is in the art world.
Thanks.
So this is going to be fun. I'm excited for this. Yeah. So I'm really excited that you're here. There's a book that was written in 2009 that's called Art and Crime, Exploring the Dark Side of the Art World. And in this book, you were described as among the most innovative and effective museum security directors in the world. That's what the book talks about. I want to talk about, first of all, what it means to be a security director, what you do on a day-to-day. And I want to talk about how secure is the average museum. Maybe let's start there. The average museum that you walk into, how secure is it? Are they vaults or what are we dealing with?
That's a very good question, Zach. And the reason it is, you know, when you go into an airport, if you ask me how secure the airports in the country, I can give you a good overview, general overview, because every airport is regulated the same way. They all fall under these federal regulations about what must be done, what must be in place, and the bare minimums. And the same is true for a lot of banks if they're federally insured, et cetera. But if you talk about museums, they're not regulated in any way. So every museum has its own standard of security. It's just as good as the security director that's there. So it's, you know, that's what's interesting. You can't really, it would be unfair for me to say how good is the security of museums in the United States or around the world, because I really don't know. You could go to a museum that has almost no standards.
Right.
A lot of times in security, people take a tombstone approach. They don't improve until something bad happens. Speaking of the Gardner, though, you had asked about day-to-day type thing. The most important thing a security director does, in my estimation, is look at your overall program. And you have to kind of look at it conceptually, like just like you're protecting Air Force One or you're protecting your family or diamonds or whatever, you need to set up layers of security so that no one catastrophic error on the part of a human being, which always happens, will lead to a total loss. So my goal, the way I look at it, is everything is just a layer. Cameras, for instance, are not your security system. They're just a layer of your security system. You know, even visitors are part of your security system. Would they say something if they saw something, et cetera? So I try to concentrate in making sure we have robust number of layers to protect the art.
So what we see in the movies where we see laser beams and we see trap doors coming in and closing in on the convicts, is any of that what's really going on in these museums? None of that.
Well, the laser beams are used for movies. You see those red laser beams.
Right.
Nobody has those in real life. Those would be telling the thief where to step and where not to.
Right.
They're much more sophisticated. It's more of something that works on an arc and would cover almost the whole room, and they're invisible. They're very effective, these motion sensors. In terms of like rooms going into lockdown, you really can't do that because if there's a fire, people have to have egress. So that stuff doesn't really exist. Like you see in the Thomas Crown Affair I think they pull the fire alarm and all the doors come shutting down.
Right, right, yep.
No way. I mean, that would be, imagine somebody getting trapped.
Right, right.
And there's a fire. So no, we don't have those. Nobody has them.
Got it. That, I mean, I guess that's good. It's good to hear. It takes a little bit of the excitement out of it, but hey. So the average museum, I know I've looked into this, and it seems like a lot of these crimes don't happen the way we see them in the movie. A lot of them happen where someone just kind of enters the museum through maybe a clever way, maybe not, and then they walk out with a painting. Is that most of what we're seeing with these robberies?
More than half of these art thefts happen in broad daylight.
Huh.
People come into a museum or a gallery and they come in as a visitor and they go out as a thief, essentially. Because you think about it, what's the point of a museum or a gallery is to give people access to these highly valuable pieces of art. And so half the battle is over for the thief if they do it during the daytime. You know, they don't have to get through this lockdown perimeter. They don't have to get through guards and whatever whatever type of, you know, all the alarms are on overnight, in other words.
Right,
but
right.
In the day, you have to turn them off. You have visitors there. So just over half the time, it happens during the daytime. You never see cases like in movies where guys come through rappelling through the skylight. I mean, it happened once in Montreal in 1972. But those guys, it seems... You know, it's 45 years ago. I guess I could talk about it without hurting anybody's character, but it seems like somebody said something in that theft. Montreal Museum of Fine Arts, thieves come through the skylight where there was construction being done. And coincidentally, the alarms weren't on right over there. So how did the thieves know this? It wasn't, there's no way that's a coincidence. There's no coincidence like that.
Right, right.
But typically, your original point is right. They're typically mundane type of smash and grab, take it and run type thefts.
So speaking that most of these are smash and grabs, like you said, I'm sure you've told this story a million times, but I would love to tell it again because I think it's such a great story, and we have you here, so I think there's no one better to tell it. I would love to talk about the robbery that happened at the Isabel Stewart Gardner Museum, which is one of the largest robberies that in existence, right?
Of anything.
Of anything.
Sure. Yeah.
And this was not really a smash and grab operation.
Right.
Right. It was so we actually had the anniversary for it a couple weeks ago, March 18th, a week and a half ago. What happened on this day? What happened on this day?
Sure. Well, it was 27 years ago on March 18th at 1:24 in the morning. So it's as St. Patrick's Day was coming the next day.
Okay.
And two thieves pulled up to the employee entrance at the museum and dressed as police officers. And they rang the buzzer. There were two guards on duty. And the guard behind the watch desk responded, and the police officer said, Boston police were responding to a disturbance. And based on that, the kid behind the desk, the guard, buzzed them into the museum. That was against policy and protocol. You were supposed to call the police. If you haven't called them, call the police, because it's a no-lose situation at that point.
Right.
Right. If you didn't, if they're not supposed to be there, the real cops are on their way. If they are supposed to be there, then everything's fine. But he didn't do that. He let them in. Once they came in, they told him to get his partner downstairs. His partner came down. His partner, these are both young guys.
And I know we're on the Berkeley Internet Radio Network, and I've heard that one of these guys was actually a Berkeley student. Is that true?
Right. The guard who let the thieves in, he messed up. He made a mistake.
Look, it happens. It happens to the best of us.
Yep. He just happened to make the biggest mistake in the history of property protection. he was a Berkeley student for, I think, 3 years. The other guard, who didn't make any mistakes that night, was a conservatory grad, I think.
Conservatory people always have their lives together.
And he's a really good guy, too. Once the second guard, the conservatory guy, came downstairs, the two cops told the guards, assume the position, get up against the wall, you're under arrest. There's a warrant out for you. And the kids complied. The thieves, the guys dressed as cops, handcuffed them both behind their backs. Once the cuffs were on, they said to them, gentlemen, this is a robbery. If you do what we say, no one's going to be hurt, etc. And they complied, and they brought the guards downstairs in the basement. They tied them up. And then the two fake cops went up to the galleries and robbed 13 pieces of art worth around $500 million.
Oh, my God.
More than that in today's money. And none of it's been seen since. They took three Rembrandt's only known seascape, and they took a painting by Vermeer, the concert, and there are only 36 known Vermeers. This is the only one in New England, and it's one of his bigger, better, everything he did was great, but it's incredible work. And these are gone. They've been gone for more than a quarter of a century now, and my job is to try to find them.
So how long after the robbery were you brought in to help locate them?
15 years.
15 years after the robbery?
Yes.
Was there someone else doing your job, and then they, or did they not even have someone in the position until they brought you on?
Well, the museum had a contract with a investigative firm. Of course, the FBI has always been looking for them, earnestly. But the museum, in a rare show of real desire to get their art back, which I think is incredibly admirable, brought in a private investigative firm to make sure that everything was being followed up on. And it's important to have someone from the museum world helping the FBI because there's perspectives that they can give the Bureau that, you know, you can't expect an FBI agent to know everything about every facility and every crime. So the museum has always pursued it. And when I came in 2005, I was working with a retired Scotland Yard, retired Scotland Yard detective who had found a lot of stolen paintings, a legendary character. His name was Rocky. And Rocky broke me into the business. I had been in Homeland Security for 15 years before that. So the museum has always worked really hard to get this stuff back. And I don't think it ever will stop.
So in hindsight, I want to talk about if you were working with the museum when the robbery happened, is there something that you could have done to have taken a precautionary action? Is there anything you could have done or have seen in hindsight that went wrong? Or was it just this fluke of events that had an unfortunate outcome?
Well, let's see. I know that the security director at the time was putting things into place and was working hard to get new security functions into place at the time. One of them would have been a control room. Control room is a common thing in facilities where someone sits away from the door and doesn't leave that room, no matter what. So he was working to have that put into place. They didn't have it at the time.
Okay.
So it's not his fault.
So if that person was in place when the robbery happened and they arrested the two guys, quote unquote, he would have come out of the shadows and broken it up, or he would have called the police or
ostensibly,
something.
Ostensibly. Because, you have human error. So.
Right.
On the night that the theft happened, the guard who let the thieves in, he was trained not to do that, but he messed up. Human beings mess up. You like to think that the guard in the control room, I've given them instructions, don't leave the control room. But you never know. The police come in, you feel pressure, they're intimidating,
right.
They're yelling, get down here. If they, I'm just playing it out. But if they had the control room in place, it wouldn't have happened. The other thing is you need to have layers in place. So that if the guard makes that mistake, he lets the police in, you still have to have layers to protect you. And there are a lot of layers that are in place now. I can tell you this definitively, and this is not me being boastful, it's just true, that technique that was used, the ruse of dressing as a police officer, couldn't work today. It just logistically couldn't happen. There's a lot of measures in place that would have stopped it. But hey, it's hindsight. For every great, horrible thing, with hindsight, you could have stopped 9/11. You could have stopped
right.
Hitler, for God's sake. So you can't really point fingers at people looking back at history.
Right. So you get into this thing. I think it's so fascinating that you get involved with it so far after it actually happens. And when you first get involved, do you feel like you're at this huge disadvantage? You're like, oh, my God, it's been over a decade since these paintings were stolen, and I'm tasked with finding them. What were you thinking when you first got this?
Well, when I first got it, I was excited for the challenge.
Yeah.
There was so much to read. I hadn't read anything that the museum had or anything that the FBI had, because the FBI has given me access to their files. So I was excited. I had all of this stuff to look into. Maybe I could find some answers. And I did. I found a lot of things in there that have helped us over time. That 15-year head start that the thieves had is more daunting to me now that I know everything. That I can know, because I see so many different things that could have been done earlier that I think would have ended this.
Like what could we have done earlier?
Without getting to specifics, there are certain avenues of the investigation that might have been taken more aggressively early on that might have yielded results. That's my feeling. I could never prove that.
Right.
But that's my feeling. There are different things that I think if they were followed up on immediately. But again, I don't want to sound redundant. None of this is any type of criticism on the investigators at the time.
Sure.
They had tons of stuff being piled on them, tons of leads coming in, and other cases to do as well. So this is hindsight speaking. So hindsight has made me look and say, Jesus, 15 years is a real killer.
Right.
But I've been looking at it for 11 and a half myself. Hopefully I'll get them back. If I don't and I'm ever replaced one day, someone's going to look at me and say, you know what, he should have looked at this earlier,
Right,
so
right.
It's really, you can always be second guessed.
So on a day-to-day basis, what keeps you going with these paintings? How do you continue to wake up in the morning and search for them after such a long time?
We always have some good leads going. And a lot of them, sometimes they come in, someone calls in something. And a lot of times you make them yourself. And one of the ways you motivate yourself is, we know what what gang was involved in stealing the paintings. We have an idea who what the gang was. It doesn't really matter who the two guys were. It matters who was involved. And I do a lot of research into that gang and their family and their girlfriends and mistresses and children and illegitimate children. You know, you name it. And what keeps me going is knowing there's more of them to talk to. And everybody you talk to leads you to someone else. So if we have a down day in the investigation, something doesn't work out, well, I know tomorrow I'm going to talk to, you know, Mr. X, and hopefully that'll yield results. So that's what keeps you going. There's no shortage of bad guys in Boston.
Yes. Do we have any guess where they are? Do we think they're in the country? Could the paintings be out of the country?
You know, anything is possible. I'm a very data-centric person. I do a lot of research and look for patterns, and it is incredibly rare for paintings that are in the United States, for a painting to be stolen in America and move very far within the U.S., but even more rare for it to leave the U.S. When paintings are stolen here, they stay here. Paintings stolen in Europe can go anywhere. You have a bunch
Why is that?
Well, in Europe, you have a bunch of small, independent, sovereign countries, right? So in the United States, if you steal a painting in Texas and you want to sell it somewhere and you hear there's a buyer in northern Maine, you can go from southern Texas to northern Maine and never see a cop, and no one's ever going to look in your stuff unless you do something bad. Right, but if you steal a painting in London and you want to bring it to Switzerland, you have border issues,
right?
Customs issues, etc. Taking something in the U.S., there's no point in trying to bring it overseas to sell it when you have 320 million Americans. That being said, they don't buy them anyway.
Right.
You know, there's no buyers for this stuff.
Where, like, what do people, I mean, you just said there's no buyers, but, like, best situation, what do people do with these paintings that they've stolen? Like, what happens to them?
Well, we're talking about masterpieces now,
right,
the highly valuable stuff. And what happens is they think they can find a buyer. They quickly find out they cannot. They learn that the stuff is really hot, so they feel, I better keep my mouth shut. They can't really market them well. So they hide them. And they hide them in places like a crawl space in the attic or in their basement, or, you know, I remember first time I met you, I told you the story about the Rembrandt that was stolen at the MFA.
Right.
By Miles Connor. He was hidden under his friend's mother's bed, you know, and she didn't even know it was there. She's sleeping every night in a bed, and underneath is this priceless Rembrandt masterpiece.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
It is. It's unbelievable.
I would love to talk about your relationship with Miles, if we can. So Miles, for those who don't know, is one of the most notorious art thieves. Can we say ever?
He's the greatest art thief who's ever lived.
The greatest art thief who's ever lived, and he happens to be one of your good friends,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I heard you just went. Did you see Springsteen?
I saw Springsteen
with him recently.
Yeah.
How did you become friends with this guy?
He's a guy I researched for a long time, and I put off meeting him for a decade.
Because you were nervous, or because
it didn't
make sense to meet him? Or
no, I wasn't nervous. You can't be nervous in this type of job. But I know he was in prison when the Gardner theft happened.
Okay, so you didn't think he was just involved?
I didn't think he did it.
Yep.
In fact, I knew he didn't.
He was in prison.
California.
Yeah, yeah.
But I knew he was probably the inspiration for it. He was probably like the... whoever stole the paintings knew what Miles had done because Miles had done it all.
Right.
And I eventually, after 10 years, because of certain people I was looking at that I feel were involved, and I know Miles knew them, one night I decided it was time to meet Miles. And through intermediaries, we set up a meeting. And the deal was I would appear in this documentary being made about him, about his rock and roll career.
Right. He was a rock and roll musician.
Yeah.
We were just talking about that a couple minutes ago.
Yeah, very, very popular. It was Miles and the Wild Ones. He was a huge star in Massachusetts music. He's in the Massachusetts Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I mean, he's just the greatest. Like, his story is so cool.
It's incredible. It's mind-blowing. And every time I'm with him, he'll say, you know, I have a humdinger for you. And he'll tell you this crazy story. But I went to meet him, and I expected, you know, it was going to be maybe contentious or, you know, a little attitude back and forth. But
a little cocky or a little full of himself, maybe.
Yeah, because we're at the polar opposite ends of the art world. He's the world's greatest art thief, and I'm this art theft investigator for the biggest heist ever. And we met, and from the handshake, we just hit it off. It was just weird. It was like we just have this appreciation, and I'm writing about it now for a future book about, I think we both have this appreciation for art that is unique from the vast majority of people. And somewhere in the middle between good and evil, you know, that gray area, Miles and I meet. It's hard to explain,
right?
But we just get along. He's just incredible. He's an incredible guy. The stories he tells, you sit there every time. You don't think it's going to happen, but you're left with your jaw hanging because you can't believe. But they're all true. So he and I have become friends. I was just at a birthday party with him a couple of weeks ago. And at the table with us is a guy who, he asked me what I do for a living. There's a guy, he said, how do you know Miles? I said, well, I'm the guy looking for the Gardner paintings. And the guy said, oh, I had a stolen Rembrandt once. I got it from Miles. I had a bag over my head and we brought it to the police and they made this exchange for Miles' sentences. And you're just sitting here. I'm looking at this guy. I'm like, you had a stolen Rembrandt in your hands. And it was like nothing to the guy. You know, it was a very nice guy, but it's just like, it was nothing to him that he was carrying a Rembrandt. Like for me, if someone said, hey, I hold this Rembrandt, I would say, where are my gloves? Are you sure you want me to hold it? I would be afraid about smudging, whatever.
Right, right. Where's the provenance? The paint,
but even putting a fingerprint on it. These guys, to them, it's another bargaining chip. Not to Miles, though. Miles understands this stuff and he appreciates it.
Is there a story that you can talk to us on air with Miles, or is there anything?
All right, yeah, I'll tell you. There's so many to choose from. I told you this one. I'll tell it again. About one afternoon in 1975, he went out to the Mead Art Gallery at Amherst College,
mm-hmm.
which is a nice little museum, and he went just to enjoy the art. He was taking it in, and he knows his stuff. And when he went into the museum, he saw in an office a painting that he thought was a Flink painting, Govert Flink, this famous student of Rembrandt's, a Dutch artist. And Miles went in to appreciate it, and he's looking, and the curator comes in, and he's asks him, what are you doing in my office? And Miles said, is that a Govert Flink? And the guy said, get out of my office. It's a working office. You have no right to be in here. He's a very mean guy, bad reputation. And Miles said, Miles is very clipped. He doesn't have a Boston accent, which is really weird. And he said, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm just wondering, is this a Flink painting? And the guy, again, just threw him out. Nasty, very nasty to him. So Miles left. He finished looking at the museum like any one of us would do. And he went home that night and he got a van and a couple of guys and he drove back.
As anyone does.
Like anyone does. And drove back to Amherst, broke in the museum, stole that painting and two others and took them because the way this guy treated him. And that people don't understand, that's not what art thieves do. They don't steal paintings for revenge like that. They steal art to make money on it, but not Miles. His motivations are always these different things. He's not only prolific, but he's and successful, but he's fascinating. You know, to get into the psychology of what motivated him. So that's why I like being around him too. I mean, if you might know, like, guys that hunt serial killers talk to serial killers. Well, I hunt art thieves, so I talk to art thieves.
Right. And do you think that that's part of his success, or why he's had such a long career as an art thief? I guess is because he's not just thinking about stealing the painting and selling it. His motives are interesting.
But he has just incredible guts.
Yeah,
he's an amazing risk taker. Like I said, his band was they'll call the Wild Ones, and he knows what to steal. Unfortunately. The Rembrandt that he stole from the MFA was the perfect steal. It's an amazing painting. Most people wouldn't recognize it. He knew. You know, I've been with him and he's shown me his samurai swords, 14th, 13th century samurai swords that he has. He knows these things inside out. Just a fascinating guy. People say to me, you're spending too much time with Miles Connor. You know, don't trust him too much. But hey, you live once and it's interesting.
Yeah. Absolutely. I love that. I think it's so cool. So I want to talk about how you got into this, because I just think it's really fascinating. So have you always loved art ever since you were young? Have you always had a passion for it?
I've always liked art.
Okay.
But when I was, grew up in the city in Providence.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know a kid growing up that went to an art museum of any
right.
sort.
Yeah, yeah.
Never. Not on school trips, nothing.
Yep.
Just wasn't a thing you thought of. The only museum I'd ever been to was Gilbert Stuart Museum in Rhode Island, and it wasn't about the paintings. It was about his snuff operation there. But I liked art, though, and I studied art history in college as a requirement. And I was working for Homeland Security for 15 years, And I had this experience in doing security for buildings and such, but also investigations. And it fit what the gardener needed at the time, because, of course, you have to protect what's there, but we also have to find what's missing. So I was kind of a good fit, the right place at the right time type thing. But I have this, in some ways it's a blessing, in many ways it's a curse. I'm an obsessive, like a true obsessive. So these empty frames are like my life. They're not something at 5 o'clock, I say, well, I'm gonna go home now. I'm texting while I was walking over here, texting bad guys and stuff and setting up meetings with them.
Yeah, how many villains are in your phone?
Too many. That is true. It's really true. And sometimes you wonder, you have your phone set up in your car,
yeah,
to your dashboard. And I'm driving with my partner, my girlfriend, whatever term is proper. And you see this number pop up with a name. I'm like, I want to put your hand over it. Like, you don't want, because they're bigger name people.
Right.
You know, because it's a big crime. So, yeah, there's too many. It'll be nice someday when I don't have to deal with them. But I will say my Miles is a big aficionado of Japanese antiquities. He knows his stuff inside out. That's his passion. Asian art, Japanese art, and my girlfriend is half Japanese. So he is really into hanging around with us and talking to her about what he has and showing her these swords and talking about, you know, the emperor in Japan and going to see silence and all these different things. So we have this little strange friendship with Miles.
That's so cool. Does he come over for dinner on Sundays?
Haven't had him over yet. I don't know if I'm going to take that step. That's right. A little invasive. We can go to restaurants.
You'll go out, but yeah. He
there's
won't
a kid
come
at
to
home,
you.
So I don't know if I'm going to take that far.
Yeah, maybe not. I want to talk about one of the books that you've written, The Art of the Con, mm-hmm. which I just read last week.
Thank you.
And I thought it was so fun, so fascinating. Such a good read. I was on spring break, so I was reading it in a park. I was in Nashville, and I was sitting back in a park and reading it. It was great. I want to. How'd you? First of all, why write this book? Why did you want to write this book?
Well, first, thank you for reading it, and I'm glad you think it was a fun read. That was the goal.
Yeah,
it was like to educate, but I wanted it to be a little more fun. Stealing Rembrandts was a little more academic.
Right,
the one about art theft. I was interested in, there's the three ways that people make money illicitly with art: theft, trafficking antiquities, and fraud. Those are the three big ones, and I didn't know as much about fraud and forgery as I would like. So I started researching it, and that developed these stories that I would accumulate. Again, they said, well, this would make a good book. It wasn't that I researched it because of a book. This was research I had done. And
Out of fascination, you were just fascinated in the topic and in the topics.
Yeah, because art crime is
right, of course.
My thing, so I can't help myself. And then I found that art forgeries and frauds are so numerous, and they're happening constantly. So I wanted to educate the public a bit about the breadth of it. You know, it's every realm of art sales or art dealing that you can look into, you find these incredible fraud schemes. So every chapter of the book, I think it's 12 chapters, every chapter is a different type of fraud. You know, there's how people do it on eBay, how people do it using the guise of these, they'll say these paintings were hidden from the Nazis during World War II.
Right. And it kind of focuses on a different, like, main person
in
each chapter, which keeps it really fun and exciting.
Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah.
I like the book. I'm proud of it. And it was what I think, you want to make a contribution when you write a book, unless you're just doing it for money. And you don't make money writing books. But unless you're like, I don't know.
J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, thank you. Right. There's always an exception, right? So you want to make some sort of impact. And there's a lot of books about art forgery. Mine's the only one that makes the claim, and it's my true belief, that the art of art forgery is not in the skill of the guy with the paintbrush. It's the skill of the con man. His ability to find the right dupe, the person who wants to believe beyond all the evidence that they found something that no one else has. It's that. That's where the skill is. It's the art of the con man. That's why I named it that. It's the art of the con, not of... Because when you look at these forgeries after the fact, they're not that great.
Right.
The people should have known. And that's a common theme in all of these. The experts that uncovered these frauds, I'll interview them and say, no, they weren't really that good. They were easy to uncover. Because it's the con that is significant. And I like that angle, and it's unique. And it's similar to when I wrote the book Stealing Rembrandts about art theft. The true art of art theft is not stealing the painting, it's trying to make money off of it.
Right.
You know, so these two things, they're both counter to what the public understands them to be. And that's what I like about these two books.
How many, is it possible to come up with a number, or do we have an estimate or a guess? I don't even know if it's possible to do this, but do we have a guess of how much art in known respected museums is fake? Is some of it fake that's on these walls that we're seeing?
Sure. Not at the Gardner.
Oh, right, okay.
But the Gardner's unique because Mrs. Gardner bought all of her stuff and it was all up in the walls by 1924.
Right.
And set in stone.
Right.
And we know what it is and it's been researched. You don't have to worry about the Gardner stuff. That's not to say some of the things, you know, she bought a painting thinking it was Rembrandt, it turned out to be Flink, that sort of thing. That's honest. Thomas Hoving, I said in the book, estimated that 50% of all the art you've seen in galleries and in museums is fake. Now,
that sounds insane to me.
That is insane. That's the type of thing you say to sell a book. But to his credit, I would say his point is valid. Suppose he's off by a factor of 10. That means 5% of all the art is fake, right? You go to a place like the MFA, they have tens of thousands of works.
Right.
Now, let me be very clear. I'm not saying that 5% of the MFA's art is fake. In fact, they are incredibly responsible. It's the first museum in America, I think the world, to have a curator for provenance.
Right, right.
Yep, and she's a brilliant and dedicated. Her name is Dr. Tori Reed. And for the MFA to do that shows you how much they strive for an ethical standard, to have somebody dedicated to making sure that their art is what it's purported to be and that its provenance is clear. That's really impressive. So I don't want to cast aspersions on them. I'm just talking, there's a lot of art out there.
Right.
And if 1% of it is fraudulent or fake, that's a lot of art. Buyer beware.
It is a lot of art.
Mm-hmm.
Doing security for a museum like the Gardner Museum that we were talking about, it doesn't really change. It can't really change. Like, you don't really bring in new works.
Right.
So does that make running security for it a little bit easier? Because you sort of know what you're dealing with, and you have this finite amount of things, and you just have to protect them. Where at a museum like the MFA, they're constantly having objects come in, they're doing new exhibits and that kind of thing. So does that create a different challenge for security?
Well, we do have new exhibitions, not in the number that the MFA does.
Right, right.
And from my perspective, it creates more challenges. The Gardner has more challenges than other museums. First of all, you can't move anything. So if you want to put different technologies in, you have to work around the stuff.
Right.
Number two, everything in the museum is part of her collection. So you go into a museum, you know, some generic MFA in some other state, and it's basically white walls with paintings on them, right? So you can go into that wall, you could do what you have to do, move the painting 10 feet to the right, not at the Gardner. And you have to have people that are really skilled to work on these walls and do the wiring. And so it presents a lot of challenges. You can't just go put new things. And Mrs. Gardner's museum is a unique experience. We don't want people to get too close to a painting, have a whistle go off, for instance. That's not what we do there.
Right.
You know, so it's. I think it's much more challenging.
I noticed when you walk into the Gardner, there's no descriptions of anything.
Right.
Is that how she wanted her work to be displayed, right?
Yeah. But I mean, Mrs. Gardner didn't want labels.
Right.
Which I think is brilliant. I mean, I find myself going to museums and I'll go to, you know, the Freck and I'll look at the label and think to myself, oh, I know that artist, and I'll look at that painting instead of just taking the paintings in and liking what I see. And that's Mrs. Gardner wanted you to just experience her. Also, her work is a collective work of art. So everything in there is her collective creation. So it doesn't really make sense to label them. That being said, I want people who haven't been to the Gardner to think, I mean, we have room guides.
Right.
We have audio guides.
So if you're not an art expert, you can figure it out.
Yes. We have a website and we have an app in development.
Right.
I think we have an app that we're testing right now. I'm not 100% sure. But you're right. The idea, you know, when the thieves came into the museum that night, though, the first painting they went for was Storm in the Sea of Galilee. And on the frame, the actual frame, you know, it's made, it says in big letters, Rembrandt. It's not a label. So they knew.
They knew that one. Yeah, yeah.
You had to know that was Rembrandt.
I want to know your favorite museum, your favorite artist, and your favorite piece of work.
Wow. Well, I'm partial to the Gardner.
Of course.
Gardner's my favorite.
Let's say we're going to exclude the Gardner because that's such an amazing museum, and I totally understand the Gardner.
Wow,
but
well,
outside of the Gardner.
This is going to be a real surprise for you because this is going to be way off the beaten path. I like to go to Peacefield, which is John Adams' homestead.
Wow.
Right over in Quincy. Second president, and it's incredible to me because everything there is his. It's the real thing, and you go upstairs. I'm into the Revolutionary War, so you know that's not everybody's bag, you know. But to me, to go upstairs, and you're standing in this hallway, and you look in this bedroom, and you see this bed, and Abigail Adams died in that bed. Abigail Adams.
Oh my God.
This incredible woman, this amazing figure. And you can see the chair where John Adams would have sat while she was ill. And you're thinking, these two people who made this country, because in my mind, she's a founding mother. That blows me away. And then to go down into there, this is going to be a little bit in the weeds, but in terms of art, you go down the stairs and you go into the living room. And above their fireplace is a painting by John Singleton Copley of Joseph Warren. And Joseph Warren, most people don't even know who he is. And
I have no idea who he is.
I'm glad. The perfect. Let me tell you, young man.
Tell me who he is.
Joseph Warren was a doctor in Massachusetts. And they often say if he had lived, he would have been George Washington.
Okay.
His brother founded Harvard Medical School. He was from Roxbury. He was this handsome guy. Women would pretend they were sick to go see Dr. Warren. And he was one of the Sons of Liberty. He was a real leader amongst Sam Adams. They all looked to him. They looked at Joseph Warren. John Adams looked to him. He was his family's physician. He was commissioned a major general in the Continental Army. And at the Battle of Bunker Hill, he hadn't received his papers yet. He insisted on fighting with the infantry up front. He was supposed to be in the back. And long story short, he died on Bunker Hill. He was shot in the face on Bunker Hill and died there. He's the martyr of Bunker Hill. He would give these orations about the Boston Massacre in front of all the redcoats. He was just this incredibly romantic figure. And even when he died, they went to look for his body. Paul Revere went to Bunker Hill to find his body.
Wow.
They dug up these corpses. And he found Paul Revere had put a filling in Warren's mouth because he was a metalsmith.
Right, so he was checking his mouth.
It's the first forensic dentistry.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
that is
Paul
so
Revere
cool.
And Joseph Warren. Right. So then John Adams' home, for all the things he did with George Washington and Jefferson's best friend on and off and Hamilton, and above his mantle, he has Joseph Warren, a study of Joseph Warren by John Singleton Copley. And it just blows me away that this guy was the revered figure in American history nobody knows about. So I have a copy of that painting in my home, and I love that painting, you know, because it just... Nobody even knows who it is. You point him out and people say, who's Joseph Warren?
Right.
You know, but he would have been, I have socks on that have George Washington on them right now.
Oh, man.
It would have been Joseph Warren if he had lived.
Well, I'm so happy to be shedding a little bit of light on him tonight. Love this. I have to ask, have you been listening to Hamilton or have you listened to Hamilton?
Love Hamilton.
Amazing, right?
Work of genius. I mean, the guy, I don't know if he can ever top it. I mean, he...
I don't think it's toppable.
How could he?
He
lyrics
can't.
Are so... The storytelling and the lyrics are so on the money.
Right.
There's a couple of places where he fibbed and he admits that, but it's so clever. It's the only word I can think of is clever. And people from... I have a 3-year-old in my car who goes crazy for it. My 20-year-old... I have a 20-year-old who... a big gap there. Who is crazy about Hamilton. My 15-year-old is crazy about it. And I love that it's telling this new story. You know, you have younger people buying biographies of Alexander Hamilton and listening to his life story in this musical. And for someone who cares about the revolution like I do, it's a godsend.
Right.
You know, what's a cool thing about it too is I read a lot of real arcane, in the weeds political writing on the right, conservative stuff too. And these guys will go see Hamilton and to review it for like National Review.
Uh-huh.
And they say, I expected to come back and tell you why I hated it, but it is the best thing I've ever seen on stage in my entire life. You know, it's got that unifying aspect too.
Right. It's,
really
it's
cool.
Just all around. It's just amazing.
It is. Yeah. It's really, is it a big deal here at Berkeley?
Some people know about it. It's a much bigger deal at the Boston Conservatory where there's the theater major and everyone there is absolutely obsessed with it. But at Berkeley, I think it's still making its way around. And I know I've spent a lot of time in Nashville, and I lived in Nashville last summer. And it's interesting because actually there, I would say 85% of the people there haven't even heard of it yet, at least
really?
When I was there last summer, which blew my mind. I was really fascinated by it. But I would talk about it with people, and they'd never heard of it, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, the touring company. When do you graduate?
I have one more year left. So I think they're coming this year in 2017 to Boston.
I thought it was 18.
It might be 18. I might be mistaken about that.
Because in Boston, it's just going to be, when that comes, that is going to be insane.
Right. It's going to be unbelievable.
It's going to be unbelievable. People are going to, you know, it's going to be the who's who gets to see it.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm going to have to see if Miles can sneak me in.
Yes. Oh, I love it. You'll be in the wings somewhere. So we have the favorite museum, favorite artist. Who's your favorite artist?
I love Rembrandt and Vermeer. They've just taken me over. And it's probably because of the theft.
Yeah.
I love Vermeer, though. Vermeer
Why do you love them? Like why? What about them?
I'll tell you. You know, I worked in these Homeland Security law enforcement positions, and I didn't think that I would ever fall in love with this stuff like mm-hmm. I did. I went to the Met to see the Milkmaid. And if you don't know the Milkmaid, Google it. Check out the image, the Milkmaid by Vermeer. And it's this woman pouring milk out of a decanter into a bowl. And there's bread behind her. It's a Dutch woman. And you look at this painting, and you just can't believe what a human being accomplished on a canvas. And you look at it and say, I can, it's going to sound corny, I can hear the milk. I feel like I can touch that bread. And it's not about the realism, you know, because there are people of photorealism painters who can make it look just like a picture. It's just the composition where you see this, the bread and the way the woman is standing and the way the light is on her, you can hear that the room is quiet except for the milk going into the bowl and the colors he uses. And it's true of when you look at the concert, the one we're missing, and you see a woman sitting at the harpsichord, and you see the back of this mysterious man playing the lute, and you see this woman just about to sing, and he nails it the way her hand is, like she's just about to deliver sound. It's a strange thing, you know, and I'll tell you, before I worked in this field, if I was listening to the show right now, I'd be like, oh, get off. Give me a break. But it's true. And that's why Vermeer does that to me. And when you see his works. But I also like Gilbert Stuart because I see him as America's Rembrandt. And he's from Rhode Island. I'm from Rhode Island. And his life story is interesting to me. It was all the money he made, he squandered. No one even knows where his bones are buried. If you walk on the Boston Common along where the, or is it the Public Gardens, along where the burial ground is, the old granary, you're walking on the outside of the old granary and the public gardens, and you'll see a plaque to Gilbert Stuart because they don't know where his bones are. So wow. There's no tombstone, you know. And so I like to see his stuff. The compositions are really just beautiful.
What's the most underrated piece in the Gardner collection? The piece that no one ever goes to see, and to you, you're just like, but it's this piece. Like, how can you not visit this one? Do you have one?
That's an outstanding question. There's a lot because I've been there 11 and a half years and I haven't seen everything.
Really?
Every time I go through, I'll sit somewhere in a gallery and I'll see something on top of a column that she put there. There's an urn from the time of Christ on top of a column that she propped up there, and I never noticed it. And you see it, like, my God. You know, this might be cheating, this answer. There's a Fra Angelico painting, a triptych. It's in the early Italian room, and she put it around the corner. You can't see it when you walk in the room. She put it there to make you go into the room because it's so famous.
Right.
It forces you to see the rest of the room. So most people don't bother. You know, they don't realize it's over there on the corner. But in a smaller piece that I really love, that's a great question. No one really mentions the Madame Gaugelin. It's a Degas painting in the Yellow Room, which I think is really cool. And, man, I'm going to be thinking of that question all night now. Excellent question, Zach.
Well, please let us know. We can put it up on the board.
That's a great question. You know, I have to hand it to you. If you don't mind me saying, you know, while we're having this interview, you ask. I always say when I talk to college audiences, or even younger, that's where the best questions come from. See, maybe a less inhibited. Your question's really good. It's a good interview.
Thank you so much. I'm honored. Thank you.
No, it's really good.
Well, I think we're just about out of time, but I would love to know. This is going out to mostly Berkeley students. Mm-hmm. But somehow, hypothetically, if anyone listening has any idea about where these stolen paintings are, how can they let you know? Or how do people let you know that they might have a tip on where these paintings are?
Well, my email address for tips on the Gardner is the easiest email address to remember ever. It's theft@gardnermuseum.org. And you can send me anything you want there. I'm interested in everything. I might not be able to reply to all of it in a timely manner. But I love reading what people have to say. I love it. It's just interesting to me.
Absolutely.
And I should have. My niece is a Berkeley graduate.
Oh, that amazing. Nice. Yep.
So I have an affinity for this school. But Ross Bressler, what a great guy.
Unbelievable.
What a great guy. You guys have a real find there.
By far, one of them, just amazing. I've never taken a class that I've been so interested in, so on the edge of my seat.
Yeah, he has this dynamism.
Yep.
That, you know, I can't say no to the guy. I just can't say, I mean, all right, Ross, no problem. Bring him on. He's a cool guy.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing that, Ross, if you're listening to this, I apologize that I'm about to say this, but I take so few actual notes in his class, and just because of the way he displays the information mm-hmm. and the storytelling and everything, I remember I'd say like 85 to 90% of everything he says, just because he just shoves it down your throat and you can't help but not absorb it and
it's
not take it in.
That's a great compliment to him.
Yeah, I mean, he's fantastic. One of my favorites for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Anthony, thank you so much. Everyone, check out his book, The Art of the Con.
Thank you.
And his book, Stealing Rembrandts. And I can personally say I just read Art of the Con, and it's a great read. It's fun. It's fast. It's easy. So everyone check it out. Anthony, thank you so much. I'm Zach Kuhn. This is the Zach Kuhn Show, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Berkeley Internet Radio Network.
Berkeley Internet Radio Network.
River flow takes me back deeper, deeper. Fresh cold as snow, broken sheet of ice. We move further, further apart. Longest time waiting for the light. The thought, shortest time drifting a sudden night. It's early. Take me back deeper and deeper. This was our home, it's growing dark. We move further, further apart. Longest time waiting for the light. They thought I, shortest time drifting a sudden night. It's early evening and I watching for each flame. I watch it fall. Should we walk away? Snow falls, I can't say. You hold me close and I'm out your way.
Oh, unfolded moment to my brain, so I can see the sun again.